Good morning. Welcome to CAPE. Our speaker this morning is a longtime Cornellian. He took his doctorate here in anthropology in 1958 and then returned after 5 years as an associate professor in the department that is now called developmental sociology. He was part of the Ford Foundation-financed golden age of rural development in what was then called the College of Agriculture. The collective goal was to save the less developed world, at least the food sector. They didn't quite make it, but everybody experimented in one way or another. Frank's talk today is an indirect product of that era because the same socio-ecological theory that explains population health in poor countries also explains why some Islamic countries and regions have become so militant. Frank will speak to us today on the Islamic Counter-Reformation, a sociological explanation.
Thanks, Carol, and thank you all for coming. I've been working on these ideas for several years now, and it occurred to me that it would be interesting to see how it plays to an audience like this, even if we aren't Peoria, Illinois. If you have deciphered my title, I don't use the word deconstructed because we don't use funny words like that up here in science land. If you've got the title, you will know that I'm going to argue for two propositions. One is that we're involved in a rerun of the European Reformation, Counter-Reformation. Structurally, I find that situation, that conflict, to be similar to what is going on today. So the story begins in 1965 or so, when a group of sociologists trained in history began to work on the independence movements after World War II, mostly in Africa and Asia and all. And then they also paid a lot of attention to the student protests that were going on. And the common denominator of all this work was a general belief that there was a way of life in the future that was better than the way of life at the present. And I ended up calling these nationalist movements. Meanwhile, in 1979, the Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers hijacked what started as a liberal revolt against the Shah and took over Iran. That was the first of several state takeovers. Sudan, I think, was next. Here, the thrust of the movement was just the opposite, that they had a way of, they imagined a way of life. Well, they drew on their past experiences to imagine a way of life that was better than the present and could be imposed by force of arms if necessary. So we had two kinds of movements, and the second one I've come to call nativist because they go back to the native roots, and this word has been used in American politics and that sort of thing. So the problem is, how can we get a grip on this phenomenon of Islamic militancy, now an example of nativism, so that we can think about it in causal terms, which I think is a goal of social science. Well, one thing we could do is to, believe it or not, count all the new mosques around the world from Google Earth. Yes, I think this could be done. And I happen to know, indirectly, that the CIA used to count communist meeting houses in the Soviet Union from aerial photographs and all. So they're probably up there counting. But that's not a very good measure for what we want. We need a little more, flesh on the bones. Well, a second move would be to track the spread of the Muslim Brotherhoods. This group, I guess we'd call it a voluntary association, was begun in 1928 in Egypt, and it has now spread to 18 countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., and surprising to me, Israel. I guess it's a legal organization. It does seem that everywhere the Muslim Brotherhood goes, a certain amount of conflict breaks out, but they claim not to be responsible for it. Well, even that, that's worth a footnote, because that's what is known in the trade as a social movement organization. Most social movements are a little broad and loose, but they often have a core social movement organization that moves them along. But there's still another way to define the problem, and that is to use a mode of definition that was introduced by the German sociologist Max Weber, who called it an ideal type. He was an economic historian and interested in patterns in the past. So he famously defined bureaucracy. Our knowledge, our understanding of bureaucracy started with this definition. And his followers went on to define democracy and totalitarianism, things like that. Well, Max Black mentioned this mode of definition when he gave his lectures on philosophy of science. He called it a range definition. And he illustrated it. Philosophers are just a lot more clever than sociologists. He illustrated it by the concept of dogginess. And the idea was to get a lot of attributes together and somehow see how they all fitted into a pattern. You can guess that the problem of identifying species and also disease syndromes, it's the same problem. Anyway, I took a crack at listing the attributes of, fan on. Oh, there it is. You have to really push. Now, you don't have to read all these things. What you have to understand is that this method of... black knob. Ah, that improves it, yeah. Is that all right? And I guess there's a dimmer here. Let's see if that improves things too. Okay? So the idea is to get a list of attributes that you think will form a syndrome or a pattern here. And so on the basis of reading, I made this list, that it starts with a drive to combat secularism by imposing Sharia law. This is the legal system that was developed about 3 or 4 centuries after Muhammad and has been improved and changed since then by the commentaries. So, and this mode of law, if applied to the present, seems out of date or it seems misplaced. So that defines this nativist tendency to go back to the past for organizational strength. We'll get into that. The second item is the drive to take control of secular governments. Now, I don't really understand why this seems to be part of the package, and maybe it will turn out not to be. By the way, there is now a statistical program, and you can have all sorts of lists and run it through this, and it shakes it all down. It could spit that one out as a mistake of this of my initial hypothesis. But maybe not, because there's a the Taliban, for one, would like to take over Afghanistan. Then, as is typical of these all these nativist movements, they appeal to a sacred book for a totalistic set of behavioral rules. Again, coding this kind of thing and figuring it out is quite subjective at the present time, but it does seem as if Sharia law, as it is implemented in some countries, read Saudi Arabia, is totalistic. And, of course, we're familiar with that various totalitarian governments. There are a number of other traits. I'll just mention them. No other religion or ideology is tolerated. Human rights are specifically earmarked in this pattern as being un-Islamic, but we'll be coming back to human rights strong. And then, of course, the strong male domination and control of women and extreme violence. According to these books that I've been reading, the punishment by amputation and stoning is quite rare, even in Saudi Arabia, although that does give them the bad press. All right, that's an example of dogginess, if you will. But there's one item down at the bottom that I didn't fit, and yet is quite important, and that is the rise of an international coordinator, or to use this military term, a force multiplier, which is the Al-Qaeda. And I mentioned that it's similar to the Society of Jesus. I'm jumping ahead of my story there, but we'll get there. Now, I'll turn this off for the moment and get the lights back on here. Full on. There we go. Now, you get this far in this game, and all of a sudden something hits you, because you've been reading about this, and that something is that Islam is only one of several religions that are erupting this way. Maybe not to the same degree, but we have at least one book entitled Global Rebellion that argues that parts of Christianity and parts of Judaism are mobilized in the same way and would like to take over the secular state. And as a matter of fact, I just read an interesting example from Israel. It seems that their ultra-conservative populations, in one neighborhood at least, wanted to segregate, and did so for a while, the bus system between males and females. Can you imagine waiting for a separate bus? It was declared unconstitutional, but these things are going on. Well, so notice what that does. In addition to this spike of militancy that we have to explain, last three decades, and in addition to Islam and now two other religions, we have a broad spectrum that has to be explained, and the task is getting more difficult. And it becomes even more difficult when you understand that the Maoists are also into this state takeover. The Maoists are active right now in Nepal, where they have won the election several years ago for parliament, and they're set to become the dominant party in that country. They're a lot more moderate than the Islamics, I'll say. The Maoists are also active in eastern India, where I just read that the Indian government will make a deal with them to put them in charge of protecting the forests, which is where they live and they're hiding out. And so the idea is to give them jobs there. Now, the third one has now been defeated by the Peruvian army. I'm talking about Shining Path. And most of them are jailed. And I've read or been told that they keep their part of the jail tidy and clean, just the way they would have run their commune had they been allowed to take over. So that's the problem. And at this point, I want to turn to the European Reformation, Counter-Reformation, to see what insights we can get from them. So another slide here. Here's a list for the Catholic Counter-Reformation. As you can guess, there is a vast library of books that somebody should read. I didn't. But it starts with the Council of Trent, which took place only 28 years after Luther pounded his theses on the church. The Catholic Church was ready for this, or at least concerned. And so they called this council, which lasted off and on for more than 10 years. Let's see. Yes. And what it did, with a lot of backing and forthing and all, was to reaffirm the orthodoxy of the medieval church. That was their conception, well, their exemplification of nativism. The books are pretty agreed on this. And I'll read you some of the attributes of this. They confirmed purgatory, indulgences, celibacy, veneration of saints, transubstantiation, seminaries for priests, bishops' authority from the Pope, not God. They revised the index, they tightened discipline, and they rejected academic studies of the Bible as not necessary, since it was true. No participation of the laity in decisions, Pope's authority supreme, and people could find God only through the church. So I've listed some other characteristics that I picked up. But again, this is a kind of a measurement hypothesis. And in order to really nail this down, you would need 30 or 40 cases and some statistics there. Let's see. I made a mistake in my listing. I listed unity of church and state, the ideal. Depends on which history book you read, but it appears that in this early period, there was an effective separation between the church and the states, mostly because they were small and, I guess, under princes going their own way. So you make these mistakes, but they get corrected in this iterative process and all. Well, let's see. Defense of territories. There were some armed warfare there, defending certain principalities. And the thing that pops up later, in contrast to this, is religion is uniform across classes, in contrast to the Protestant solution, which was to develop denominations for the classes. centrally selected priests and bishops, etc. Well, you get the idea. Now, of course, what's really new is the formation of the Society of Jesus. Ignatius Loyola became active only 5 years after Luther exploded on the world. And the Jesuits were organized, as you know, along military lines. They established seminaries and parochial schools. And they, while they worked diplomatically, they had allies who fought. And they were able to reclaim a number of Catholic territories there, part of France, part of Belgium, Austria, and especially Poland. The other amazing thing that happened under the Jesuits was an explosion of missionary work, especially to Asia, something that the Protestants later did not do. Now I'm going to put the Protestant list on right away. So we can turn this off. And again, I read the wrong book or misinterpreted it. In that period, at least, there was not a separation of church and state. Each one of these new denominations, Lutherans, the Calvinists and all, at least had a strong alliance with some government. But we do have the class stratification of denominations, pastors selected by congregation or by the congregation instead of from above, voluntary conversion, and on down the list. Now, the thread that runs through this for me, and there has to be one if the correlations identify this as a cluster, the thread that runs through it is a certain flexibility of organization in contrast to the hierarchical structure of the Catholic Church, especially in the South. And so what we're looking at, it seems, is the rising town organization in the North, up into Scandinavia, along with emerging commerce, not industrialization quite yet, in contrast to the remnants of the feudal system down in the South. And I mention this contrast because that probably is part of the causality, but it's the way we can talk about strong and weak, because already the hypothesis to explain these is coming into view. And it goes as follows, that a weak society faced with an existential threat will develop a nativist social movement as a defensive move. And so the question is, well, what is strong and weak? I'm going to give you a technical definition later. But already, we're looking at the social structure of these towns in the North, and where all the Lutheran churches were sprouting up. And in contrast to we'll call it feudalism, it was much more complicated than that, as things usually are. So we're going to run into this hypothesis, again, and that will be the end of the talk. All right. We're now ready for the big question. What is the modern equivalent, if we want to pursue this analogy, the modern equivalent of the Protestant Reformation? And whatever it is it enough of a threat to account for this global rebellion that we're seeing around the world? Well, there are quite a number of candidates. Jealousy of American freedoms and way of life is the explanation that George W. used to give, although I'm sure it was just in speeches. And the mass media diffusion of the excesses of the 60s, with the obvious recommendation that Hollywood should be burned down. And the third possibility, which was proposed in a book, seriously, is the blowback from U.S. proxy wars. According to this book by a Columbia professor, the U.S. Couldn't fight the Soviets directly on, so they did it by proxy wars. And we taught the locals all sorts of nasty tricks, and especially in Afghanistan, and they carried these over and are now applying them back in their home countries and to us. Well, those have not done very well, although there's not that much critical discussion of them, but they're overshadowed by the most popular explanation, which I'll make a guess, at least half of you have espoused at one time or another, and that is American imperialism or the evils of American foreign policy. Now here we have an interesting list. It seems that in the CIA up to, 5 years ago, there was a committee or a group that was tracking bin Laden. And of course, they were listening to his speeches and all. So they made a big list of all of his complaints. This list, which is published, goes on for 5 or 6 pages. But I'm going to give you a summary of this, and I think you'll find it interesting. Here's the summary. Right off, bin Laden criticized the U.S. For challenging God's word by declaring jihadists to be criminals. Then he criticized the U.S. support, support of oppression in Kashmir, the Philippines, Chechnya, the Chinese province of Xinjiang, and in Palestine. Then U.S. troops were sent to the Philippines, Caucasus, Yemen, and Eastern Africa. All these bin Laden doesn't like. It supports apostate Islamic governments in Kuwait, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. And it occupied Iraq in order to control its oil. And it helped the UN to separate Timor from Indonesia and to set it up as a Christian state. Then there was the U.S. occupation of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the smaller states in the Gulf. And I suppose Cornell's relationship to Qatar is part of that list. And finally, the U.S. backing of the Israeli occupation of Muslim Palestine. Well, there's a lot of discussion as to whether those charges are true. And you can go back and forth about it. But here's the point. Even if all of them are true, that list does not add up to a cause. Because if there's any idea, primitive idea about causality, and it's a muddled topic, I agree, it is that the cause has to be strong enough in some sense to account for the effect. And this list is like trying to drive a nail with a feather duster. All the foreign policy feathers just don't have any power. And it's just not possible that all those people in the Middle East know about all these evil policies. They do parrot the general phrase, but the fallacy of that is that just because you can name something, American foreign policy, with a few words, doesn't mean that it's an organized entity. So that's my criticism of that one. And of course, I think there's a better one. And the event that opened up a whole new social movement, and which I believe is the cause of the worldwide global rebellion, is the United Nations acceptance, with abstentions, in 1948 of the Universal Declaration for Human Rights. It contained 30 clusters of positive rights that fall into two broad categories, but let me define positive here. Up to the Declaration, we've had a lot of bills of rights going back to the Magna Carta. But almost all of these, and the list, the items in them, were attempts to protect citizens from the tyranny of the state. Now, this one is different because, yes, it includes a number of those things. I'm going to read them to you. But it includes rights like the right to marry or the right to leave your country and come back, things that are not part of the older pattern. And that's why it was so radical. Now, I don't need to tell you that there were some abstentions and objections to this. The Soviet Union objected to all these human rights because that was somewhat contradictory to the totalitarian system that they were running. South Africa didn't like it for obvious reasons, apartheid. And what was the other one? Not China, they weren't part of the UN then. The other one is, this always slips my mind, but Saudi Arabia. Speaking for the Arabic countries, and they objected to it on grounds that we would now call cultural relativism, because these rights undercut their way of life, and they denied that that was a good thing. But it did pass, and so the document which Eleanor Roosevelt, by the way, she chaired it, and she thought this was the most important contribution in her whole career, and as you'll see. So there were two groups. The first was the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Happiness got dropped out, as you see. And freedom from slavery and torture, equality before the law, protection against arbitrary arrest, detention or exile, the right to a fair trial, the right to own property, political participation, the right to marriage, fundamental freedoms of thought, conscience, and religion, opinion, and expression. Those are familiar. And peaceful assembly. All right, then the second category includes economic, social, and cultural rights, which relate to, amongst others, the right to work, equal pay for equal work, that was in there in 1948, the right to form and join trade unions, to have an adequate standard of living. These are still being worked out. But what really did happen was a very rapid spread of these ideas, these rights, practically around the world. And more to the point, these rights in this document were rapidly incorporated into national laws. They became laws of the land. So it wasn't just a spread of some ideas, some idealistic ideas. What else happened? As I said, Eleanor Roosevelt chaired this committee and worked it through the UN with great effort. A study of this period in Roosevelt's life has appeared under the title of A World Made New, because that is what has unfolded. Now, the writer here is a Harvard Law professor named Marianne Glendon, who has written a book called Rights Talk, where she looks at the spread of this, and then what's the other one? It'll come to me. And there are books called The Rights Revolution. Anyway, there is this explosion. I will admit that some of it passed me by, even though I was kind of looking for something like this, and I didn't realize what I was seeing. But this, I suggest to you, is the causal hammer that drives the nail. This explains why we're having this global rebellion around, because, and we'll get into this, the rights revolution is diametrically opposed to many of the forms of government that we still have in the world. So, if we were to make a list of attributes, what would it look like? Boy, that's a stiff thing. Well, these are not the best items for various reasons that will appear. Let me get this straight. Oh, excuse me. I was playing games and trying to figure out what Max Black must have said there. Oh, that's embarrassing. You are not supposed to see that. Okay, here we go. So here's table 4, an example of a nationalist social movement, which I call Reformation 2. And I believe that it could be shown that there's a widespread belief that the future way of life can be formulated that is superior to the present. And part of it has already been formulated in the form of the Declaration of Human Rights. And notice that most of these rights redound to the benefit of minorities. And that is also another new factor in this equation. The Bill of Rights in the American Constitution, after all, were for voting citizens, mostly men. They were, in fact, all men in those days. Now it's for everybody. And so what we're seeing is that in very remote parts of the world, people are demanding their rights. You wouldn't think they'd ever heard of it. And this rights talk, to use another one of these book titles, is used on both sides, because a pregnant woman has a right to abortion, but on the other side, the fetus has a right to life. And so everybody's claiming rights. And then there are some funny uses of it. Let's see if I can find it. I was in the Philadelphia airport a couple of weeks ago, where I probably caught my cold after a vacation. What did I see there? Anyway, there was a big sign, letters a foot high. You have a right to visit downtown. I think that was it. What could that possibly mean? That despite shooting at you, you have this right to go down there? Yes. Well, anyway, I'm still trying to find that, but rights talk is everywhere. Okay. Now, I've spun these out. C is a mistake. That's not an attribute that you could code or replicate, and also it goes off the point. We're talking about the core of this new movement, world movement, which is rights and all. But some of the familiar ideas are there. Now the question is, what caused it all? The rule is, then, that societies facing an existential threat will respond with nativism. Existential threats tend to be human. People can rise above earthquakes and floods, But it's pretty bad when you lose a war and then you're the victims of genocide. Now, the American South, after they lost, did not develop a nativist movement, but there was and is a lot of nostalgia about the old Confederacy there. So that was a milder version. But these things, these nativist movements, are happening all over. And I'll end my talk with one that you will never guess. The reason that weak societies reach to the past is that that's all they have. Weakness means that they just don't have any tools. They don't have the social organization to move ahead. And we now have a rather remarkable documentation of that. The UN wrote, or had written, by Arab scholars, a volume on human development in Arab countries. And they found some disheartening things. Here's one fact they turned up. On average, only 4.4 translated books per million people were published in the first 5 years of the 1980s in the 22 Middle Eastern countries that they were studying. And that's compared to 519 books in Hungary and 920 books in Spain. All these figures of intellectual strength go that way, that nothing is happening, or not much is happening along these lines in the Middle Eastern countries. Another statistic that's tossed around is that if you take away the GNP from oil from these countries, then the amount of GNP that's left is equivalent to what Finland makes each year. Finland equals 22 countries. And the oil money is even worse because those countries that have it don't charge taxes, and then the citizens have no right to challenge the government on that ground that they're being taxed with and the government is ineffective. So it's not a very good situation. But it goes deeper. A lot of people are working on the problem of what is a weak and versus a strong state. And you've heard the term failed states that are happening around the world. Now, here is my technical definition, that problem-solving capacity, which is the name of the game, I believe, for states and all sorts of communities, is the application of specialized knowledge, the institutionalization of nonviolent argument in parliaments and on the street and on all for adjudicating policy directions, and third, the capacity to have a reform movement on occasion when things can't be handled any other way. I consider these three master strategies for survival to be primordial. Back when the cavemen were in charge, they depended on these three strategies. Well, and by that tally, it's never been done, but if the Middle Eastern countries and various others around the world were tallied up, this would divide them between the strong and the weak. Now, let me end with a little example of how all this works. You know, in the books about teaching, they say you should wrap your principle in an anecdote. And that's what people remember. Okay. Well, you all know that Larry Summers got into trouble, what was it, 6, 7 years ago at Harvard, for suggesting in what he thought was a closed meeting. Meetings are never closed in universities. She should know better than that. For remarking that maybe there should be studies made of this discrepancy between, well, the infrequency, relative infrequency of women in physics and math and the hard sciences. And you know what happened? One of the feminists, chemists in the audience stormed out because she knew what the real cause was. It wasn't genetic or temperamental or any of that. It was male oppression. So that was the match that lit the fire, and it rolled along. Now, you know, Summers had been challenged with a vote of no confidence before, a couple of years. Well, pretty soon there was a threat of another vote of no confidence, and this one, Summers didn't think he could win, so he stepped down. Well, sounds clear enough, you know, angry people, arrogant presidents and all that. That's the way the world works. Well, it happens that an article came out in the Journal of Higher Education, the Chronicle of Higher Education, by a couple of, well, I don't think they're sociologists, they're sort of social psychologists. Anyway, they had another take on it. They said, all that business about angry people and arrogant people is beside the point, not the cause at all. The real cause of what is going on, what happened at Harvard, was the shift in the center of gravity from that sacred Harvard yard and the humanities there to the new applied science campus across the Charles River, which they had been buying the property, as you know, for the last 20, 30 years. And now Summers' mandate was to build that second university. Well, that is an existential threat to people who think, now in the humanities campus, who think that their subjects are the source of truth and wisdom and, you know, you name it. As a matter of fact, the law school was offered the chance to move across the river, and they politely declined on the grounds that they couldn't really think very well over there. So they're still there. Okay, so these structural shifts go on. It's nobody's fault. It's hard to blame anybody. But that's what causes these eruptions, because here the humanities faculty was under an existential threat. It just happened, and they fought back and finally brought down the head of state. Thank you. I'm ready for some questions now, and we can kick this around. Let's see, I better look at my watch. Well, I'll ask a question for you, which would, will, oh, excuse me, sorry. Yes, let's take you.
Yes, I'm gonna start, so maybe everybody can hear me. I really appreciate your quantifying, if I may call it that way, systematically analyzing the different characteristics of what's happening in, let's say, the Middle East in general, or vis-a-vis what has happened in the European Reformation movement. However, and I do accept maybe partially your last argument that it is an existential threat, but I think your primary assumption is based on the question of, if I did understand your argument well, is based on two things. One, you jumped from the movement, the social movement of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Khomeini movement, immediately to the Taliban, which is a very small minority, it doesn't even count to 1% of the total 1.3 billion Muslims, which are, in a way we could call them in biology, these are the disease. You're analyzing from the disease and implying for the totality of the population. That's one point that I do not accept that assumption. The second point is the Reformation movement, and part of the problem of the absentia in the vote in the UN in 1948 against the Declaration of Human Rights was the propaganda of the nation state concept, which is completely, completely unacceptable to the Muslim mind. And there where the problem started, not because of certain right or so on and so forth. Thank you.
Well, yes, the rights and what was going on in the UN was completely unacceptable to the states that objected, and that's the point. The question is, how deep did that objection go? And I call it an existential threat. Had the Declaration of Human Rights actually been imposed, and it wasn't, they would have had great concern there. Now, I'm not sure I understood the first point, but let me spin it out a bit. Social movements never involve the whole population. Judging from the polls that have been taken in Muslim countries, though, these Islamic parties could win any election. You know, 60, 70, 80% support these Islamic parties. They could win any election that they were permitted to vote in. And you probably know that in Algeria, they were close to winning the election, and the army moved in and canceled the election. So there's a lot of support there. And then there's a layer of maybe 20, 30% of the population that know about the militancy and are actively supporting it some way. And finally, there are the fighters, maybe 5 or 10%. So I don't have to account for the whole society to make this hypothesis work, I think. I don't know whether I'm really responding to your point, but let's go along here and circle around it. Is there another one? Yes.
Yeah, the issue of the reformation and possibility of that in the Muslim world, you're right in the sense that some of the present global uprising, in a way, if you want to call it, is saddening. But we have to look at these movements and see why they are where they are. Be critical. The Taliban, strongly supported by the US government and by the Saudi and the Pakistan, this is a fact, supported by politically and militaristically before, of course, their involvement with Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden and so on. So that their existence and their predominance in Afghanistan was a direct Western making. This is the truth for Hamas. Hamas was the making of the Israeli government, right, with a strong support later by different entities in the Middle East, like Egyptian and so on, and eventually turned into what they are now. Hezbollah. The invasion of the American in Lebanon was direct involvement. Muslim Brotherhood, the Eisenhower administration, the role of Jamal Abdel Nasser, was a critical in their militarization of Muslim Brotherhood. And you have a case like this, I'm mentioning just an example, and just 2 weeks ago, Hillary Clinton has no shame if lecturing us about lack of democracy in Iran, and she giving us this lecture in the United Arab Emirates and in Saudi Arabia. The two states that the least democratic of them all.
Okay, so I agree with everything you're saying.
Yeah, what I want to say is that there's a need for Muslims to re-examine the premises why those extremists taking over. And that's a burden on the Muslim to reform the rethinking, not Islam, but the way they interpret Islam. But we need the West to have an open mind, an open heart.
Okay? No problem with that. And I think a lot of that is the foreign policy, the American foreign policy argument that that's the cause of all this. But notice what's going on. This is a style of thought, which I call social thought, and it's a good way to think. And I read the New Republic, and I get all their ideas sometimes, etc. Now, I'm trying to break out of that. And I'm trying to pull back and not blame anybody. I'm a Spinoza type, you know, that to understand all is to, most of the time, forgive all. And that's maybe a motto that a lot of sociologists believe. I certainly do. So here I was trying to play a different game. I don't think any of you have ever heard this kind of argument, kind of thing. So all I can say is, well, I laid it on the table, and yes, it would take a couple of million and 5 years to even do a preliminary test of this. Actually, that's not the right way to do it. What we need in sociology is the equivalent of fruit flies. Remember those little bugs that they did genetics on? The best we have, well, I gave you one there. The shift in the balance in the center of gravity in probably the top 20, 30 universities. It's all going on now. It happened at Cornell from the humanities to science and all. These things really frighten people, and they don't even know where it comes from often, these causes. So we have two lines of argument here. Yours makes sense to me. I could flip a switch and maybe help you out on some of that. But I'm trying to flip the old sociological switch, and which has an outrageous assumption, you probably notice. I'm saying that I can formulate a hypothesis that will cut through all of these things going on. That's the standard objection to this line of thought, that how can you say that there's a simple hypothesis that explains these things when the world is so complicated? And of course, my answer is, as soon as you get the simple rule, it's not complicated. But that's you can see that I'm full of myself. Somebody will ask, probably it's in your mind, well, so what? This is all very interesting, you know, and this is what we do in universities. But what does this theory suggest that we might do about this? And this articulates with this idea of a Muslim reformation, which there are all sorts of initiatives going on in the Muslim world, just as they did in the Catholic world and all. Well, the first thing I think that should be done, apart from this theory, actually, is to examine the few cases now where an Islamic party has joined the government. There's a book out by Noah Feldman on the Islamic State, and he thinks it would work. That is, if countries took on Sharia law, that they could run a country with one caveat, he says, they would have to put checks on the power of the executive to keep these dictators from popping up, which they do no matter what the ideology is. So there's a lot of interest now in how Sharia law, I'll call it, can be merged with modern law, I guess, derived from Roman law. There are a lot of possibilities there, and I guess the American military is hoping to negotiate with parts of the Taliban. But when we get down to this particular theory, here are the options. There are just two levers, two super variables. One is threat, and the other is problem-solving capacity. Well, We can't take away the threat because we're it. That certainly in universities, this business of human rights is almost taken for granted. So could we close down the universities? Well, no, that's not possible. And it's not possible to stop the spread of human rights. I'd say that's a given. Now, it's true that the assumption of national sovereignty is a barrier to that, and also cultural relativism. So the countries that think differently about this have their defenses. And they can turn off their TVs, you know, if they're oppressed by that. That's what I do. Now, the question of greater problem-solving capacity is a tough one. It is true that cities are spreading around the world, and cities are the great container of specialized knowledge. Here in Ithaca, when we have a problem, no matter what it is, they call up the lawyers and they call up the this's and the that's's and they work at it. But sometimes that doesn't work and people get into arguments, as they should, and that's a core feature of democracy. But in a larger sense, this business of contestation, as the political scientists call it, over options, policy options, is quite healthy. Could we stop that? Probably not. It could be modified, I guess. People could be a little more polite. But again, they get into the heat of the argument. I don't see much give in these things. According to this theory, it's a deterministic, a semi-deterministic theory, and it doesn't allow much room. But on the other hand, I know from reading history that civilizations, religions, can live together. They have in past times. And under normal circumstances, ordinary people are not bothered by contradictory positions, only when it comes to their own personal circumstances. So an awful lot could be accomplished just by the old ways of compromise and adjustments. Actually, there's an interesting process going on in Great Britain right now, and that is that the Muslim communities are using mediation to deal with family matters among Muslims. And mediation is perfectly legal in the UK, and there are many varieties of it. But then the new wrinkle is that after a decision has been made, the mullah or whoever he is, the person in charge, takes it to the British law courts and asks for a stamp of approval as accepted in British law. Now, that is what is actually going on. Technically, it shouldn't, according to lawyers and all, but that's the way or societies adjust. And it probably will, the situation is ironic over there because British law already makes provisions for Jewish and Christian adjudications of family problems and all. There's already a provision for that, so why not for the Muslims? Almost certainly that's the way it'll go, and there'll be a separation between family law and maybe criminal law and, of course, foreign policy. Anything else? So let's see. Okay.
I'm sorry to say that I disagree with this assessment that it's okay to work the way the British are trying to, especially, particularly with the comment by the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Ah, yes, you know the whole story.
We should accept the Islamic Sharia. The problem with this is the word Islamic Sharia or the concept or what's being called Islamic Sharia is very erroneous. What we understood in the West as Islamic law, it does not account for what is the actual Sharia in the Quran, the sacred text. what's being propagated by those mullahs in Britain or any minority community in the West, including the US and Canada, is that what's being practiced in certain countries as Islamic Sharia. Those laws actually were not only based in the Quran, they were based on what practiced in the local community at the time, being formalized and stand as the local law, Sharia, by the colonials. So they were a mesh of many colonial laws, whether British, Dutch, or French, and some of the local practice, and they are called Islamic Sharia. We don't want those laws to be transmitted or transfused into the West, and that's very problematic for
Okay, I'm British glad you brought that up. It's in my notes to mention. I don't know it as well as you, but in all of these legal systems and all, there are lots of variations. Now, my conception of what goes on is that when societies are in crisis, they go through a lot of trial and error and borrowing and fiddling and all, and it's almost Darwinian in the way you have explosions of mutations and all. But it is certainly not true that there is a Sharia law and that it is can be imposed on situations without change. There's lots of possibilities. Time to stop.